The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 3, Continued. Cassette 11, Side 1. In that convoy of Don Cossacks, when the men arrested at the meeting were carried separately from their women, one woman gave birth to a child on the journey. Their rations were one glass of water a day, and 300 grams of bread, not every day. Was there a medical attendant? Need you ask? The mother had no milk, and the child died on the way. Where were they to bury it? Two soldiers climbed in for a short trip between two stations, opened the door while the train was moving, and threw the tiny body out. This transport was driven to the great Magnitogorsk building operation. Their husbands were brought to join them. Dig away, house yourselves. From Magnitogorsk on, our bards have done their duty and reflected reality. The Tomardovsky family were carted only as far as Yelnya, and luckily it was April. There they were loaded into boxcars. The boxcars were locked, and there were no pails or holes in the floor for them to relieve themselves. Risking punishment, perhaps even imprisonment for attempted escape, Konstantin Trivonovich cut a hole in the floor with a kitchen knife while the train was moving and there was a lot of noise. The feeding arrangements were simple. Once every 3 days, pails of soup were brought along at main stations. True, they were only travelling for 10 days, to a station called Lyalya in the northern Urals. It was still winter there, and the transport was met by hundreds of sledges, which carried them up the frozen river into the forest. There they found a hut for 20 loggers, but more than 500 people had been brought, and it was evening. The Komsomol in charge of the place, a Permian called Sorokin, showed them where to knock pegs into the ground. There'll be a street here, there'll be houses there. This was how the settlement of Parcha was founded. It is hard to believe in such cruelty. On a winter evening, out in the taiga, they were told, "You've arrived!" Can human beings really behave like this? Well, they're moved by day, so they arrive at nightfall. That's all there is to it. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands were carried into the wilds and dumped down like this. Old men, women, children, and all. On the Kola Peninsula, Apatiti, people lived through the dark polar winter in thin tents under the snow. But was it so very much more merciful to take trainloads of vulgar Germans in summer? Summer 1931, not 1941. Don't confuse the dates. To waterless places in the Karaganda steppe, ration their water, and order them to make themselves earth houses? There, too, winter would come soon enough. By the spring of 1932, the children and the old had all died of dysentery and malnutrition. In Karaganda itself, and in Magnitogorsk, they built long, low, communal buildings of earth, like vegetable storehouses. On the White Sea Canal, the new arrivals were housed in huts vacated by prisoners. Those who were sent to work on the Volga Canal, even just beyond Khimki, were unloaded before there was a camp, tipped out on the ground as soon as the hydrographic survey was completed, and told to start swinging picks and wheeling barrows. The papers reported the delivery of machinery for the canal. There was no bread. They had to build their earth houses in their spare time. Nowadays, pleasure boats carry Moscow sightseers over this spot. There are bones on the bottom, bones in the ground, bones in the concrete. As the plague approached in 1929, all the churches in Archangel were closed. They were due to be closed anyway, but the very real need for somewhere to put the de-kulakized, hurried things along. Great streams of deported peasants poured through Archangel, and for a time the whole town became one big transit prison. Many tiered sleeping platforms were put up in the churches, but there was no heat. Consignment after consignment of human cattle was unloaded at the station, and with dogs barking around them, the bast shod went sullenly to church and a bed of planks. S, then a boy, would never forget one peasant walking along with a shaft bow around his neck. He had been hurried away before he could decide what would be most useful. Another man carried a gramophone with a horn. "Cameramen, there's work for you in this." In the Church of the Presentation, an 8-tiered bed platform, which was not fastened to the wall, collapsed in the night, and several families were crushed. Their cries brought troops rushing to the church. This was how they lived in that plague-stricken winter. They could not wash, their bodies were covered with festering sores, spotted fever developed. People were dying. Strict orders were given to the people of Archangel not to help these special resettlers, as the deported peasants were now called. Dying peasants roamed the town, but no one could take a single one of them into his home, feed him, or carry tea out to him. The militia seized local inhabitants who tried to do so and took away their passports. A starving man would stagger along the street, stumble, fall, and die. But even the dead could not be picked up. Besides the militia, plainclothes men went around on the lookout for acts of kindness. At the same time, market gardeners and livestock breeders from areas near big towns were also being expelled, whole villages at a time. Once again, what about the theory that they were supposed to arrest exploiters only? And the residents of Archangel themselves dreaded deportation. They were afraid even to stop and look down at a dead body. There was one lying near GPU headquarters, which no one would remove. They were buried in an organized fashion by the sanitation department, without coffins, of course, in common graves next to the old city cemetery on Vologda Street, out in open country. No memorials were erected. And this was while the tillers were still only in transit. There was also a great camp for them beyond the village of Talagi, where some of them were given jobs loading timber. But one man contrived to write a letter abroad on a log. See what happens if you teach peasants to read and write. And they were all taken off the job. Their path was still a long one, to Oniga, Piniga, and up the river Dvina. We had a joke in the camp. They can't send you farther than the sun. But these peasants were sent farther, to a place where there would long be no shelter for a tallow dip. The plight of these peasants differed from that of all previous and subsequent Soviet exiles, in that they were banished not to a center of population, a place made habitable, but to the haunt of wild beasts, into the wilderness, to man's primitive condition. No, worse, even in their primeval state, our forebears at least chose places near water for their settlements. For as long as mankind has existed, no one has ever made his home elsewhere. But for the special settlements, the Cheka, not the peasants themselves, they had no right of choice, chose places on stony hillsides, 100 meters up above the river Pinega, where it was impossible to dig down to water, and nothing would grow in the soil. 3 or 4 kilometers off, there might be convenient water meadows, but no, according to instructions, no one was supposed to settle there. So the hay fields were dozens of kilometers away from the settlements, and the hay had to be brought in by boat. Sometimes settlers were bluntly forbidden to sow grain crops. What they should grow was also determined by the Cheka. Yet another thing we town folk do not understand, what it means to have lived from time immemorial with animals. A peasant's life is nothing without animals, and here he was condemned for many years never to hear neighing or lowing or bleating, never to saddle, never to milk, never to fill a trough. On the river Chulim in Siberia, the special settlement of Kuban Cossacks was encircled with barbed wire and towers were put up, as though it were a prison camp. Everything necessary seems to have been done to ensure that these odious work fiends should die off quickly and rid our country of themselves and of bread. Indeed, many such special settlements died off to a man. Where they once stood, chance wayfarers are gradually burning what is left of the huts and kicking the skulls out of sight. No Genghis Khan ever destroyed so many peasants as our glorious organs under the leadership of the party. Take, for instance, the Vasyugan tragedy. In 1930, 10,000 families, 60,000 to 70,000 people as families then went, passed through Tomsk and from there were driven farther, at first on foot, down the Tom, although it was winter, then along the Ob, then upstream along the Vasyugan, still over the ice. The inhabitants of villages on the route were ordered out afterward to pick up the bodies of adults and children. In the upper reaches of the Vasyugan and the Tara, they were marooned on patches of firm ground in the marshes. No food or tools were left for them. The roads were impassable, and there was no way through to the world outside, except for two brushwood paths, one toward Tobolsk and one toward the Ob. Machine gunners manned barriers on both paths and let no one through from the death camp. They started dying like flies. Desperate people came out to the barriers begging to be let through and were shot on the spot. Rather late in the day, when the rivers unfroze, barges carrying flour and salt were sent from the Tomsk Integral Soyuz, Producers and Consumers Cooperative, but they could not get up the Vasyugan. Stanislavov was the Integral Soyuz agent in charge of the shipment, and it is from him that we know this. They died off, every one of them. We are told that there was at least an inquiry into this business, and even that one man was shot. I am not much inclined to believe it, but even if it is so, the ratio is an acceptable one, the ratio with which we are familiar from the Civil War. For one of ours, 1,000 of yours. For 60,000 of yours, one of ours. There's no other way to build the new society. And yet, exiles survived. Under their conditions, it seems incredible, but live they did. In the settlement at Parcha, the day was started by four men, Komidzirians, with sticks. All their lives, these peasants had begun their day themselves, but now they were driven out with sticks to fell and raft timber, by giving them no chance to get dry for months on end, by cutting down the flour ration. The masters exacted their stint from them, and in the evenings they could get on with homemaking. Their clothes fell to pieces on their bodies, and they wore sacks like skirts, or else stitched trousers from them. If they had all died off, a number of towns we know today would not exist. Igarka, for instance. The building of Igarka from 1929 on was carried out and completed by whom? The Northern and Polar Timber Trust, I wonder. Or was it perhaps dekulakized peasants? They lived in tents at 50 degrees below, but they made possible the first timber exports from the area as early as 1930. The former kulaks lived in their special settlement, like zeks in maximum punishment camps. Although there was no boundary fence, there was usually a man with a rifle living in the settlement, and he alone said yea and nay. He had the right, on his own authority and with no beating about the bush, to shoot anyone deemed unruly. The civic category to which the special settlements belonged, their blood ties with the archipelago, will quickly become clearer if you remember the law governing a fluid in interconnected receptacles. If a shortage of labour was felt at Vorkuta, special settlers were transferred, without retrial, without relabeling, from their settlements to the camps. And they lived behind the wire as meekly as you could wish, went to work behind more wire, ate dishwater soup, only they paid for it, and for their guards and for their huts, out of their wages. And no one saw anything surprising in this. The special settlers were also torn from their families and shifted from settlement to settlement, just as zeks were shifted from camp to camp. In one of those strange vagaries to which our legislation is subject, the USSR Central Executive Committee promulgated a decision on July the 3rd, 1931, permitting the restoration of civil rights to former kulaks after 5 years if, in a settlement under police control, mind you, if they have engaged in socially useful work and shown their loyalty to the Soviet regime, by, let us say, helping the rifleman, the settlement manager, or the security officer at his tasks. But this was mere foolishness, the whim of a moment, and anyway, as the 5 years were ending, so the archipelago was hardening. There seemed to be never a year in which it was possible to make conditions easier. First there was the time after Kirov's assassination, then 1937 to 1938, then from 1939 there was war in Europe. And in 1941, our own war began. So that a safer way was found. From 1937 on, many of these same hapless alleged kulaks and their sons were plucked out of the special settlements, labelled with a clause from Article 58, and shoved into the camps. True, when during war there was a shortage of reckless Russian fighting power at the front, They turned, among others, to the kulaks. They must surely be Russians first and kulaks second. They were invited to leave the special settlements and the camps for the front to defend their sacred fatherland. And they went. Not all of them, however. N.K.H. blank V, a kulak's son, whose early years I used for Turin, but whose subsequent biography I could not bring myself to recount, was given the chance, denied to Trotskyite and communist prisoners, however much they yearned to go, of defending his fatherland. Without a moment's hesitation, K.H. blank B snapped back at the head of the prisoner registration and distribution section, "It's your fatherland. You defend it, you dung-eaters. The proletariat has no fatherland." Marx's exact words, I believe, and certainly any camp dweller was still poorer, still lower, still less privileged than any proletarian. But the camp disciplinary board had not mastered this fact, and it sentenced K.H. blank V to be shot. He sat in jail 2 weeks with a topper hanging over him, hating them too much to appeal for clemency. It was they who made a move and commuted his sentence to a further tenor. It sometimes happened that they transported ex-kulaks out into the tundra or the taiga, let them loose and forgot about them. Why keep count when you'd taken them there to die? They didn't even leave a rifleman. The place was too remote, too inaccessible. Now that the mysteriously wise leaders had dismissed them, without horses, without ploughs, without fishing tackle, without guns, this hard-working and stubborn race of men, armed perhaps with a few axes and shovels, began the hopeless fight for life in conditions scarcely easier than in the Stone Age. And in defiance of the economic laws of socialism, some of these settlements not only survived, but became rich and vigorous. In one such settlement, somewhere on the Ob, but on a backwater, nowhere near the navigation channel, Burov had landed as a boy, and there he grew up. He tells the story that one day before the war, a passing launch noticed them and stopped. The people in the launch turned out to be the district bosses. They interrogated the Burovs. Where had they come from and how long ago? The bosses were amazed at their wealth and well-being, the like of which they'd never seen in their collectivized region. They went away. A few days later, plenipotentiaries arrived with NKVD troops, and once again, as in the year of the plague, they were ordered to abandon within an hour all that they had earned for themselves, all the warmth and comfort of their settlement, and dispatched with nothing but a few bundles deeper into the tundra. Perhaps this story is enough in itself to explain the true meaning of kulak and of de-kulakization. The things that could have been done with such people if they had been allowed to live and develop freely. The old believers, eternally persecuted, eternal exiles, they are the ones who 3 centuries earlier divined the ruthlessness of the heart of authority. In 1950, a plane was flying over the vast basin of the Podkamennaya Tunguska. The training of airmen had improved greatly since the war, and the zealous aviator spotted something that no one before him had seen in 20 years. An unknown dwelling place in the taiga. He worked out its position. He reported it. It was far out in the wilds, but to the MVD all things are possible, and half a year later they had struggled through to it. What they had found were the Yaroyevo old believers. When the great and longed-for plague began, I mean collectivization, they had fled from this blessing into the depths of the taiga, a whole village of them. And they lived there without ever poking their noses out, allowing only their headman to go to Yaroyevo for salt, metal fishing and hunting gear, and bits of iron for tools. Everything else they made themselves, and in lieu of money the headman no doubt came provided with pelts. When he had completed his business he would slink away from the marketplace like a hunted criminal. In this way the Yaroyevo old believers had won themselves 20 years of life. 20 years of life as free human beings among the wild beasts, instead of 20 years of Kolkhoz misery. They were all wearing homespun garments and homemade knee boots, and they were all exceptionally sturdy. Well, these despicable deserters from the Kolkhoz front were now all arrested, and the charge pinned on them was, guess what? Links with the international bourgeoisie? Sabotage? No. Articles 58.10 on anti-Soviet agitation, and 58.11 on hostile organizations. Many of them landed later on in the Jezkazgan group of steppe lag, which is how I know about them. In 1946, some other old believers were stormed in a forgotten monastery somewhere in the backwoods by our valiant troops, dislodged with the help of mortars and the skills acquired in the Fatherland War, and floated on rafts down the Yenisei, prisoners still and still indomitable, the same under Stalin as they had been under Peter. They jumped from the rafts into the waters of the Yenisei, where our Tommy gunners finished them off. Warriors of the Soviet Army, tirelessly consolidate your combat training. No, the doomed race did not all die out. In exile, more children were born to them, and they too were attached by inheritance to the same special settlements. The son does not answer for the father, remember? If a girl from outside married a special settler, she passed into the serf class and lost her rights as a citizen. If a man married one of those, he became an exile himself. If a daughter came to visit her father, they corrected their error in missing her before and added her to the list of special settlers. These additions made good the deficit as settlers were transferred to the camps. Special settlers were very conspicuous in Karaganda and round about. There were a lot of them there. They were attached in perpetuity to the mines of Karaganda, as their ancestors had been to the factories of the Urals and the Altai. The mine owner was free to work them as hard and pay them as little as he liked. We are told that they greatly envied prisoners in agricultural camp divisions. Until the 50s, and in some places until the death of Stalin, special settlers had no passports. Only with the war did the Igarka exiles begin receiving the polar wage rate. But now that they have survived 20 years of plague and exile, now that they are free at last from police supervision, now that they hold their proud Soviet passports, who and what are they in their hearts and in their behavior? Why, what else but Soviet citizens, guaranteed in good condition? Exactly the same as those reared simultaneously by the workers' settlements, trade union meetings, and service in the Soviet army. They too can muster the courage to slam down their dominoes almost boldly. They too nod agreement to every shadowy presence on the television screen. When required, they too will angrily stigmatize the Republic of South Africa or collect their kopecks for the benefit of Cuba. So let us lower our eyes in awe before the great butcher, bend our heads and bow our shoulders in the face of the intellectual puzzle he sets us. Was he right, after all, that reader of men's hearts, to stir up that frightening mixture of blood and mud, and to go on churning year in and year out? He was right, morally. No one bears him a grudge. In his day, so ordinary folk say, it was better than under Khrushchev. Why, on April Fool's Day, year in and year out, cigarettes went down a kopeck and fancy goods 10. Eulogies and hymns rang in his ears till the day of his death, and even today we are not allowed to denounce him. Not only will any censor stay your pen, but anyone standing in a shop or sitting in a train will hasten to check the blasphemy on your lips. We honor great evildoers. We venerate great murderers. And he was even more right politically. This bloody mix was the cement for obedient Kolkhozes. No matter that within a quarter of a century the village would be a desert and the people spiritually extinct. No matter, our rockets would be flying into space and the enlightened West fawning on us, cringing before our achievements and our might. Chapter 3. The ranks of exile thicken. Only the peasants were deported so ferociously to such desolate places with such frankly murderous intent. No one had been exiled in this way before, and no one would be in the future. Yet in another sense, and in its own steady way, the world of exiles grew denser and darker from year to year. More were banished, they were settled more thickly, the rules became more severe. We could offer the following rough time scheme. In the 20s, exile was a sort of preparatory stage, a way station before imprisonment in a camp. For very few did it all end with exile. nearly all were later raked into the camps. From the mid-30s, and especially from Beria's time, perhaps because the world of exile became so populous, think how many Leningrad alone contributed, it acquired a completely independent significance as a totally satisfactory form of restriction and isolation. In the war and post-war years, the exile system steadily grew in capacity and importance together with the camps. It required no expenditure on the construction of huts and boundary fences, on guards and warders, and the washroom and its capacious embrace for big batches, especially those including women and children. At all major transit prisons, cells were kept permanently available for women and children, and they were never empty. Husbands who were also being deported did not travel with their wives. There was a standing order that members of condemned families should be sent to different places. Thus, when the Kishinev lawyer I.K. Gornik was exiled as a Zionist to the Krasnoyarsk region, his family were sent to Salekhard. Exile made possible a speedy, reliable, and irreversible cleansing of any important region in the mainland. The exile system established itself so firmly that from 1948 it acquired yet another function of importance to the state, that of rubbish dump or drainage pool, where the waste products of the archipelago were tipped so that they would never make their way back to the mainland. In spring 1948, this instruction was passed down to the camps. At the end of their sentences, 58s, with minor exceptions, were to be released into exile. In other words, they were not to be thoughtlessly unleashed on a country which did not belong to them, but each individual was to be delivered under escort from the camp guardhouse to the commandant's office in an exile colony, from fish trap to fish trap. Since the exile system embraced only certain strictly defined areas, these together constituted yet another separate, though interlocking, country between the USSR and the archipelago, a sort of purgatory in reverse, from which a man could cross to the archipelago but not to the mainland. The years 1944 to 1945 brought to the exile colonies unusually heavy reinforcements from the liberated, occupied territories, and 1947 to 1949 yet others from the Western republics. All these streams together, even without the exiled peasants, exceeded many times over the figure of 500,000 exiles, which was all that Tsarist Russia, the prison house of nations, could muster in the whole course of the 19th century. For what crimes was a citizen of our country in the 30s and 40s punishable by exile or banishment? Bureaucrats must have derived some strange pleasure from this distinction, since, though not observed, it was continually mentioned throughout those years. When M.I. Bordovsky, who was persecuted for his religion, expressed surprise that he had been exiled without trial, Lieutenant Colonel Ivanov graciously explained, "The reason there was no trial is because this is not exile, but banishment. We do not regard you as a convicted person and are not even depriving you of your electoral rights." These, of course, being the most important constituent part of civil freedom. The commonest crimes can easily be indicated. 1. Belonging to a criminal nationality. For this, see the next chapter. 2. A previous term of imprisonment in the camps. 3. Residence in a criminal environment, seditious Leningrad, or areas in which there was a partisan movement, such as the Western Ukraine or the Baltic states. And then many of the tributaries enumerated at the very beginning of this book branched out to feed the exile system as well as the camps, continually casting up some of their burden on the shores of exile. Who were these people? Above all, the families of men condemned to the camps. But families were by no means always drawn in, and it was by no means only the families of prisoners who poured into exile. Just as it requires extensive knowledge of hydrodynamics to explain the currents in a fluid, without which you can only observe in despair the chaotically swirling and howling element, so here. We lack the information to study all the differential impulses which in various years, for no apparent reason, sent various people not to camps, but into exile. We can only observe the bewildering mixture of resettlers from Manchuria. Individual foreign subjects, even in exile, they were not allowed by Soviet law to intermarry with fellow exiles who were nonetheless Soviet subjects. Certain Caucasians, no one remembers a single Georgian among them, and Central Asians, who, for having been prisoners of war, were sentenced not to the usual 10 years in a camp, but a mere 6 years of exile. And even some former prisoners of war, Siberians, who were sent back to their native districts and lived there as free men, without having to report to the police, but also without the right to leave the district. We cannot go into the different types and cases of exile, because all our knowledge of it derives from casual stories or letters. If A.M.A.R. blank V had not written his letter, the reader would not have the following story. In 1943, news came to a village around Vyatka that one of its kolkhoz peasants, Kodzurin, a private in the infantry, had either been sent to a punitive unit or shot outright. His wife, who had 6 children, the oldest was 10 years, the youngest 6 months old, and 2 sisters of hers, spinsters nearing 50, also lived with her, was immediately visited by the executants. You already know the word, reader. It is a euphemism for executioners. They gave the family no time to sell anything. Their house, cow, sheep, hay, wood were all abandoned to the pilferers, threw all 9 of them with their smaller possessions onto a sledge, and took them 60 kilometers in a hard frost to the town of Vyatka, Kirov. Why they did not freeze on the way, God only knows. They were kept for 6 weeks at the Kirov transit prison, then sent to a small pottery near Ukhta. The spinster sisters ate from rubbish heaps, both went mad, and both died. The mother and children stayed alive only thanks to the help, the politically ignorant, unpatriotic, in fact, anti-Soviet help, of the local population. The sons all served in the army when they grew up and are said to have completed their military and political training with distinction. Their mother returned to her native village in 1960 and found not a single log, not a single brick from the stove where her house had been. A little cameo like this can surely be threaded on the necklace of our great fatherland victory, but nobody will touch it. It isn't typical. To what necklace will you add? To what category of exiles will you assign soldiers disabled in the fatherland war and exiled because of it? We know almost nothing about them. In fact, hardly anyone else seems to. But refresh your memory. How many such cripples, some of them still not old, were there, crawling around market tea rooms and suburban trains at the end of the war? Then their ranks were swiftly and discreetly thinned. This was also a current, a campaign. They were exiled to a certain northern island, exiled because they had consented to be mutilated in war for the glory of the fatherland, and in order to improve the health of a nation, which had by now won such victories in all forms of athletics and ball games. These luckless war heroes are held there on their unknown island, naturally without the right to correspond with the mainland. A very few letters break through, and this is how we know about it. And naturally on meager rations, because they cannot work hard enough to warrant generosity. I believe they are still living out their days there. The great purgatory in reverse, the land of exile that lay between the USSR and the archipelago, included big towns, small towns, settlements, and completely uninhabited areas. Exiles tried to get permission to go to the towns, rightly considering that it's easier there for the likes of us, particularly in the matter of work, and that their lives would be more like those of ordinary people. Perhaps the main capital of the exile world, and certainly one of its pearls, was Karaganda. I saw something of it before the end of general exile in 1955. The police had allowed me, an exile, to go there for a short time. I was going to get married to another exile. At the entrance to what was then a hungry town near the ramshackle station building which trams could not approach too closely for fear of falling through into mine workings near the surface, and next to the tram turntable, stood a truly symbolic brick house, its wall buttressed by wooden beams to prevent it from collapsing. In the centre of the new section of town, the words, "Coal is bread," for industry, were set in stone in a stone wall. And indeed black bread was on sale in the shops there every day. This was what made exile in town so much easier. There was heavy work to be had, too, and some less heavy. For the rest, the food shops were pretty empty, while dizzy prices made the market stalls unapproachable. Two-thirds, if not three-quarters, of the town's inhabitants at that time had no passports and were required to report to the police. From time to time I was recognized and hailed in the streets by former Zeks, particularly Zeks from Ekibastuts. What sort of life did an exile have there? At work, an inferior position and depressed wage, for not everybody after the catastrophe of arrest, prison and camp had the means of proving his qualifications, and any allowance for length of service was still less likely. Or perhaps they were simply in the position of Negroes who do not get paid on the same level as whites. If you don't want the job, you can please yourself. Then there was a great shortage of apartments. Exiles lived in unscreened corners of corridors, in dark box rooms, in little sheds, and always paid through the nose because it was all rented privately. Women no longer young, worn to a frazzle by the camps, with metal teeth, dreamed of having one crepe de chine going-out blouse and one pair of going-out shoes. Then again, distances in Karaganda are great, and many people had a long way to travel to work. It took the tram a whole hour to grind its way from the center to the industrial outskirts. In the tram opposite me sat a worn-out young woman in a dirty skirt and broken sandals. She was holding a child with a very dirty diaper, and she kept falling asleep. As her arms relaxed, the child would slide to the edge of her lap and almost fall. People shouted, "You'll drop him!" She managed to grab him in time, but a few minutes later she would be falling asleep again. She was on the night shift at the water tower and had spent the day riding around town looking for shoes and never finding them. That was what exile in Karaganda was like. As far as I can judge, it was much easier in Jambul. In the fertile southern belt of Kazakhstan, food was very cheap. But the smaller the town, the harder it was to find work. Take the little town of Yeniseisk. When G.S. Mitrovich was being taken there from the Krasnoyarsk transit prison in 1948, he asked the lieutenant escorting his party whether there would be work. "Of course there will," the lieutenant cheerfully replied. "And somewhere to live?" "Of course." But having handed them over to the command post, the escort went off, traveling light. While the new arrivals had to sleep beneath overturned boats on the riverbank or under open-sided sheds in the marketplace. They could not buy bread. Bread was sold to those with a fixed address. And the new arrivals could not register. To find lodgings, you had to put down money. Mitrovich, who was entitled to a disablement pension, asked for work in his own profession. He was a livestock specialist. The post commander did a bit of quick thinking and telephoned the agricultural department of the district Soviet. "Listen, if you give me a bottle, I'll give you a livestock specialist." This was a place of exile where the threat, "For sabotage, you'll get 5814, will put you back in the camp," frightened nobody. Another piece of information about Yeniseisk dates from 1952. One day, when they went into report, the desperate exiles started asking the post commander to arrest them and send them back to the camp. Grown men, they could not earn their bread in that place. The post commander chased them away. "The MVD isn't an employment office, you know." He had no obligation to know, and the prisoners were not allowed to know the laws of the land of the Soviets. Article 35 of its criminal code, for instance. "Exiles must be endowed with land or provided with paid work." Here is an even more godforsaken place, Tasiyevo in Krasnoyarsk territory, 250 kilometers from Kansk. This was used as a place of exile for Germans, for Chechens and Ingush, and for former Zeks. It is not a new place, not recently invented. The village of Kandali, where in the old days they used to forge chains, Kandali, for convicts, is nearby. But what is new there is a whole town of earth houses with earth floors. In 1949, a group of repeaters was brought there toward evening and unloaded at the school. A commission met late at night to take over the new workforce. The commander of the district MVD post, someone from the timber cooperative, the Kolkhoz chairman. Before the commission passed in slow procession, people old and sick, exhausted by tenors in the camps, and most of them women. It was they whom the state in its wisdom had excluded from the dangerous towns and thrown into this harsh region to tame the taiga. The employers were reluctant to take such workers, but the MVD left them no choice. The most hopeless rejects among the goners were foisted on the salt works, whose representative was late for the meeting. The salt works were on the river Usolka, at the village of Troitsk, also an ancient place of exile. Old believers were driven there in the reign of Alexei Mikhailovich. In the middle of the 20th century, the technique in use was this. They drove horses around in circles to pump brine onto filters and then obtained salt by evaporation. The firewood was brought from the logging sections. This was where they hurled the old women into action. A successful and well-known naval architect had landed in this party. He was given a job as close as possible to his old profession, packing salt in boxes. Kniazev, a 60-year-old worker from Kolomna, fetched up in Tasayevo. He was past working and had to beg. Sometimes people would take him home for the night. Sometimes he slept in the street. There was no room for him in the old people's home, and the hospital wouldn't keep him for a long at a time. One winter's day he crawled up the steps of the Raikom, the local committee of the Workers' Party, and froze to death. Zex, transported from a camp to exile in the taiga, in 20 degrees of frost and the backs of open lorries, ill-clad with only the clothes they were released in superannuated tarpaulin shoes, while the escort troops were wearing sheepskin coats and felt boots, could not believe their senses. Was their release to mean no more than this? In the camp there were heated huts, and here they had an earth house left by loggers and unheated since last winter. The power saws had roared in the camps, and they roared here. These saws were the only means in either place of earning a ration of half-baked bread. So that new exiles were apt to make mistakes, and when in 1953 the deputy director of the timber enterprise, Leibovich, arrived all clean and handsome at Kudzeyevo in the Sukhobudzim district, Yenisei, they took one look at his leather overcoat and his sleek, pale face, and greeted him incorrectly. "Good day, citizen chief." Leibovich wagged his head reproachfully. "No, no, what's all this citizen stuff? You must call me comrade now. You aren't prisoners any more." The exiles were assembled in the one and only earth house, and the deputy director harangued them by the somber light of a spluttering oil lamp, like a man hammering nails into a coffin. "Don't imagine that you are here temporarily. You really will have to live here forever. So get to work as quickly as you can. If you have a family, send for them. If you haven't, marry among yourselves without delay. Build yourselves homes. Have children. You will be given a grant for a house and a cow. To work, comrades, to work. Our country needs our timber." With this, their comrade rode off in his motor car. It was as a special privilege that they were allowed to marry. In the wretchedly poor settlements on the Kolyma near Yogodnoye, for instance, Retz recalls that there were women who were not allowed to go to the mainland, yet the MVD forbade exiles to marry them. Families would have to be given accommodations. But not allowing exiles to marry could also be a concession. In northern Kazakhstan in 1950 to 1952, some MVD posts tried to tie the exiles down by confronting new arrivals with this stipulation: "Marry within 2 weeks, or we'll send you into the interior, into the desert." It is a curious fact that in many places of exile, the camp term "general duties" was used quite straightforwardly, not as a joke, because that was what they were, exactly the same as in the camp, the necessary heartbreaking jobs which ruin a man's health and do not pay a living wage. And though the exiles, as free men, were now supposed to work shorter hours, 2 hours there, to the pit or the logging section, and 2 back, brought their working day up to the camp norm. The old worker, Berezovsky, a trade union leader in the 20s, who had endured 10 weary years of exile from 1938, only to be sentenced to 10 years in the camps in 1949, tearfully kissed his camp ration in my presence and said happily that he would not perish in the camp, where he had a right to bread. As an exile, even if you go into a shop with money in your pocket and see a loaf on the shelf, they may look you brazenly in the eye, say, "No bread," and sell some to a local while you watch. It is the same with fuel. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.